Hi everyone, my name is Rohan Sant.
And my name is Daniel Olaya. Thank you very much for joining us and welcome to another episode of the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
We are extremely privileged today to welcome one of the most prestigious guests we have ever had on the podcast, Dr. David Powell. David is currently the medical advisor to the International Airline Transport Association, an international body representing airlines worldwide, and has an extensive background in aviation medicine, including being a Royal New Zealand Air Force medical officer, group medical officer for Virgin Australia, and the chief medical officer for Air New Zealand for 12 years.
Now, in his role at IATA, he was one of the premier consultants for the aviation industry tackling the COVID-19 pandemic. And outside his professional life, he's a qualified pilot on both fixed wing and rotary aircraft.
Without any further ado, David, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the podcast.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hi, Rohan. Hi, Daniel. Hello, everybody. And thanks. It's great to be with you.
It's such a pleasure to have someone with such an extensive CV on the podcast, David. How are you doing? How's life working at IATA currently? How's that goal going for you?
Thanks. Very kind. It's good to, it's going well. In fact, I am currently in the UK and will shortly be in Geneva at the IATA headquarters for the first time since before the pandemic. So it's been a long spell of remote working, but I'll spend a bit of time in Geneva.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, welcome to the UK. You know, we've got good weather at the moment, so I'm sure you're enjoying that. And I just have to say that actually researching you and finding out about your career has been so much fun. And normally it takes quite a long time to do that about these amazing careers that, you know, we get to talk to people about. But yours, you know, I was just finding out so much, and it was such a story and an adventure that clearly your you know, career has been. So that was a lot of fun.
Thanks very much. Nice of you to say that. And it'll be interesting to just chat through some of it.
So, David, the question we ask everybody who comes on the podcast, can you tell us about your path to aerospace medicine? How did you get involved? When did that first start?
Yes, of course. So as a young fellow, I guess I always had some inkling of interest in aviation. It was always there. I got to fly as a passenger a little bit in light aeroplanes and even once in a helicopter. And I suppose it sat there latent. And when I qualified as a young intern or house surgeon and started to get an income, I spent my first paycheck on flying lessons. And so I was captured by that. And it was a question of how to somehow combine this this newfound interest in flying with medicine. That led to a whole lot of interesting places, starting with the Air Force.
So does that mean that you were in medical school and then after that you decided that actually aviation medicine is a thing? How did you actually come along with aviation medicine as a career path? Did you know about it at medical school, or was that something that you were just trying to combine the two together in some way?
The latter. I hadn't really heard of aviation medicine, but started to ask around a little bit, and there were some possibilities, and somebody said, well, you should talk to these guys at the Air Force. And I remember going up to meet with them for lunch at the officer's mess, and they showed me around and said, well, you know, here's some things you should do. And before too long, I was accepted as a young officer in the Air Force, and I did it 8 years, but it was punctuated by a little spell in anesthesia in the middle for about 18 months.
I think it's a really good point. We've had a few guests now who have at least alluded to, obviously, the draw of the military organizations such as the Air Force, especially for the aerospace medics. I noticed when I was at ASMA earlier this year, we had a lot of people from the military who were actually there and representing. I was just wondering, what would you say to somebody who was in a similar sort of position? So say that, you know, you're in final few years of medical school, you've heard about aviation medicine. What's the sort of pros and cons of the military that it gave you that you wouldn't have been able to explore in civilian life, for example?
Well, yeah, I guess the military isn't necessarily for everybody. But for me, it was a springboard to amazing opportunities. And so for the 8 years that I did, I had a ball, and it usually began with the phone ringing, and there was some request that came out of nowhere.
There's got to be a story behind that somewhere.
Yeah, I worked in New Zealand. So, you know, it was a very small military, a tiny Air Force, about 100 aircraft, 3,500 people. But and in terms of the military, medical people, the Air Force had, I think, 8 doctors at the most, maybe 6 for most of the time I was there. So what that meant is each of us really got to do a bit of everything. So it was very varied. And I would add that I joined on the promise of being considered for the entire flying training program, because in our Air Force, this used to happen every now and then, once every 5 to 10 years, certain professions, psychology, medicine, or engineering, they would choose somebody to do all of the flying training program.
Wow.
So I was really hoping for that. Ironically, I didn't get that because my eyesight didn't meet the medical standard for pilot recruits, and they wouldn't give me a waiver. But by then I was in and having a great time and doing all sorts of things, including aeromedical evacuation, getting posted to the islands on sort of a public health program to eradicate yaws on an island, military exercises, exchanges with overseas. A little bit later, running the aviation medicine unit, including controlling the altitude chamber, crash investigations. So, you know, really great variety. It was a fantastic job.
Wow. So what I'm getting is a real broad-based training kind of feel. And what I'm really interested is this anesthetics and GP interplay that you had, and how did that come about, and what exactly did that involve?
Well, to be honest, Daniel, I thought this has been great, but it's time to leave the Air Force and get a real job. And so I went off and began anesthetics training. And I really liked it. But after about a year, 15 months, I thought, yeah, I really like it, but maybe I'm not going to be happy with this for an entire career. And I know you'll know some of what I'm talking about. You know, maybe I don't want to be locked up in a room with no windows with people that maybe aren't that easy to get on with all day long. and for permission to go to the toilet. So an opportunity came back to rejoin the Air Force, but this time in charge of the aviation medicine unit, which was doing the really interesting things. And back then New Zealand had some fast jets, not many, but some, and that whole aspect of aviation medicine so much more interesting when you've got that sort of aircraft on board.
So fairly early on in your career, you were picking great aspects of these specialties and adding that to your forte, which is obviously taking you to where you are now. And I think that's an incredible concept. Unfortunately, there's not really a lot of that left, particularly in the British system. I don't think you stick to your specialty and you're there forever. You can't really, you know, explore like that.
But I think that's the truth is still that being in uniform does afford great opportunities and experience. Of course, there's a downside to it as well, which is that if your nation decides that you're going to war, then that's what you're going to do. And that indeed happened with me in the first Gulf War. We had a couple of months involved with that conflict, but that again and turned out to be really very interesting, and it was something that I wasn't uncomfortable with participating in.
That's interesting. I'd love to be able to explore that a little bit more. How was it like? Were you deployed in a sort of an aviation medicine capacity or a sort of general duties medical office capacity then?
General duties, yeah. So I was part of a very small 20 person team deployed and attached to the Royal Air Force in, we didn't know where we were going, but when we got to UK for our sort of final pre-deployment training, they told us that we were going to Bahrain. And almost the entire team were sent to the what was then called the RAF War Hospital, Muharraq. But just
wow.
on day one, they asked for two volunteers, a medic and a doctor, to instead be deployed across the road to the actual detachment where the RAF were flying Tornadoes, Buccaneers, Jaguars,
yeah,
and
of course.
The tankers. And so my hand shot up immediately, and I got to be the doctor that went over and did that, which was to be for the detachment, looking after the personnel and preparing for sort of emergency response. Again, terrific experience, wonderful.
I've got to explore that a little bit further. So, I mean, I've actually just read a book from a some of the gentlemen that were deployed in that first Gulf War. One of them was the navigator on one of the Tornadoes that got shot down. And how was that being the medical officer on there? Because especially at that time, there is that sort of, as from what I understand it, a them and us mentality between air crew and the medical team. So especially in that very dynamic environment, how did you deal with those challenges as they came up?
Yeah, and I know well the books you're referring to. But I have to say that we were a bit late to the conflict. So by the time we got there, those incidents, including that shoot down, had already occurred. And
of course.
And so we didn't lose any during my time. The answer to your question is we were there in support of the aircrew. It was pretty tough for them. And, you know, the Air Force differs from the Army, and it's just a small group that are actually sent to the conflict, and the rest are well back. So everybody else is in support of them. The shift work was an interesting challenge because there was basically a night crew and a day crew, and they didn't cross over all that much. And the night crew had to fly about 4 a.m., which means briefing about 2 a.m., which means trying to go to bed to get enough sleep at about 7 p.m. Impossible.
Wow.
How do you go to sleep at 7 p.m. knowing that you're going to get up in the middle of the night and go get shot at?
Yeah.
So that was where the RAF, in relatively controlled fashion, was using hypnotics, to help these guys manage that schedule. And very successfully, both during the conflict and at the end when it came off. Other issues, just, in support of the general practice needs and if somebody gets sick, can they fly? Can they not fly? Vaccines, the peculiar things that we were dealing with in terms of preparing for possible chemical or biological attacks, and response to airfield emergencies. It was a pretty crazy place because there wasn't just the RAF detachment. There were aircraft from a lot of other countries around the world coming in and out, as well as the normal civilian traffic in and out of Bahrain Airport.
One of the things that I think came up in this particular book was the psychological impact that was there upon the aircrew. I don't know if that was really an issue that you had to necessarily deal with or combat, but was there any sort of relevance of the psychological aspect of it from your time there that you could reflect upon, perhaps?
I think, as is often the case with these kind of severe challenges, people often cope really well at the time, and it's afterwards when the chickens come home to roost. And I think that's probably the case with the stories that you're referring to as well. We saw some, but not a whole lot really of psychological fallout at the time. I think the hypnotics were an interesting thing to watch because some people had a kind of a rising requirement, as you might expect, as things dragged on. But, the great thing, of course, in that first Gulf War was that it wasn't a prolonged air war, 40 days from memory. And towards the end of those 40 days, the scenarios that we were so fearful of, you know, just began to change, it became apparent that really the threat was going to actually be a hang of a lot less than we'd feared. Because we started out expecting, you know, incredibly high numbers of casualties, potentially chemical ones, and that just didn't take place.
So, and you talked about the sort of fallout that occurred often after the incident or after the war was over. I think one of the things that was talked about was the debriefing being really important after the mission in terms of like a real, from the psychological point of view. Is that something that actually was true and that's what happened? Or have we learned a lot since then about how we deal with those things and how to the preventative measures that we can do to prevent, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder developing in our crews?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I don't claim to be an expert on that whole field, but I know a lot of great work has been done, particularly in the UK, actually, on this over the years. A number of individuals, particularly Sir Simon Wessely and Neil Greenberg.
Exactly.
And part of it was to debunk the idea that became vogue back in the kind of 90s or even sooner about the necessity to have an obligatory immediate and detailed psychological debrief with a professional. And, you know, this idea really gained prominence worldwide. But as time went on, it became clear that actually doing that was more likely to be harmful than beneficial. And what was instead necessary was the support of one's peers, the opportunity to talk when and with whom people wanted, and the opportunity for support when required. A lot of that really is about normalizing the whole the psychological experience of traumatic events, because, as we said, you know, people were shot down, people were lost, people were imprisoned and tortured. But there's another aspect that I think is worth touching on, and that's something I have seen and observed in a number of these different operational theatres, and that's when people return from that environment back to normal civilian life. That's a hard adjustment to make, because when you're in the midst of something that provides you with an overwhelming sense of purpose every single day, every hour of that day, with a bunch of people who are sharing that same purpose and immediate kind of presence in what's going on, suddenly that gets removed at the end. And that I did see in a few people really taking its toll. They just didn't know what to do returning to normal life. So, you know, part of what gets talked about is post-traumatic stress, but some of it really is kind of post-purpose or post even post-excitement stress.
It kind of reminds me of, is it sort of like a come-down thing? For example, I'm just thinking it's nowhere near the same way. You know, if you've had a big event that you've been organizing and spent so much time preparing for, and then it happens in that day, and then after, what have you got left to do with your day? It's kind of like a very, very heightened version of that. Is that kind of what you're referring to, David?
Yeah, it is. It's probably depicted well in if you ever saw the movie The Hurt Locker, which is about a guy who's
yes,
defused bombs. There's a wonderful scene where he's back home and he's in the supermarket shopping and trying to decide which of the many, you know, breakfast cereals to buy, and then suddenly he just loses it. And you kind of get that. It's about, you know, where's the purpose to all this?
And obviously that's not actually going to be purely for the air crew or the people that you're looking after, but I would have presumed that for yourself coming off deployment, there must have been an element of that as well, David. Are there any things that you found that were particularly helpful for preventing that sort of thing from happening, or ways that you went about dealing with it that worked for you and maybe would work for some other people who may be listening?
I don't claim to have any great insights into that. But you're right. I think it's a common thing in a whole bunch of fields. Even, you know, being a junior doctor actually brings that kind of sense of living on the edge, great purpose. And I think that can take a little while to recover from. I think perhaps a healthy degree of understanding that the situation you're in is not normal is a big help.
So, David, already in your medical career, and this was about 6 years into it, around 1992, because you graduated around 1985, you've experienced so much, a little bit of GP, some anesthetics, and then you're in the theater of war with all these things happening and you're gaining all this experience. Then after that, what happened and what did you do?
The sequence is actually that the Gulf War was before I left and went and did anesthesia for a while. So I guess that was part of my kind of response to returning was I'll go off and do this specialty training. And then I rethought it and pursued aviation medicine from there on, really.
And did you feel that actually that skill set in anesthesia, after experiencing all those things and in the theater of war, did you say, actually, yeah, I want that subset of skills because of what I've been through and because I want to have behind me?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, having those kind of specialist skills makes you so much more useful, or let's say puts you potentially into a whole lot more possible roles that can be really interesting and challenging.
It's, you know what I'm really hearing as well, Daniel, is that one of the things really is that you can feel a little bit like you're on a bit of a hamster wheel when you're going through medical school, for example, or even through allied health professional training. And then once you're on a path, you can't get off. But I think what we're seeing with David's career, and I can even remember with Terry's career when we had discussed it in episode one of our first season, is that we're seeing people who have really applied themselves to multiple different specialties and succeeded and exceeded and tried everything out and found the thing that they're really passionate about. And I just think that's wonderful that you felt you had that freedom to be able to explore those things, David. I think that's really, really cool. So, David, you've talked obviously about the different professional placements that you've done. I noticed from your CV that you've also done various different qualifications within aviation medicine. So can you talk us through what made you do those qualifications and how they were, and also whether you'd recommend anyone in a similar position pursuing those as well?
Sure. Well, I guess I was looking to carve out some sort of career progression that involved aviation medicine. So back then, there were two real options. One was the UK diploma, which is now the King's diploma, but back then it was run by the Royal Air Force.
Yeah, correct.
And it was 6 months full time. And so to get that amount of time off work, really you needed to be sponsored through that.
Absolutely. Mm.
That was an option, but there was also a new, relatively new, postgraduate distance taught diploma from New Zealand. So it was started off by somebody who's now a very good friend, and I was in the second or third year of that, really. So it was a four-year part-time distance diploma before the days of Zoom. So, you know, it involved audio conferences in some sort of specialized center within a university, and lots of reading. But, you know, I did that and completed it and loved it, actually. It was the first time, to be honest, that I'd studied and actually enjoyed studying. And then at the end of that, for various reasons, the opportunity came up to go to the UK and sit the RAF diploma without doing the six-month course, because by then I was working full-time in aviation medicine and you could do that, so I did that as well. And, you know, those, whilst they're just diplomas, they are qualifications that open doors in the tiny, obscure world of aviation medicine.
Wow. I absolutely second that completely, that it was so enjoyable. I mean, I just did the King's College version, which was possibly different to yours when it was run by the RAF. But for the first time in my medical career, I was extremely enjoying the learning process of learning about ejection seats. And obviously, having not been in the RAF beforehand, all this was very, very new to me, learning about the engineering and being surrounded by all these different people when I went for the 2-week revision course. But I want to find out, why did you do 2 diplomas? You got the 2 diplomas. You've done it all. Why?
Oh, look, it was just the peculiarities of training. New Zealand and Australia had occupational medicine as a recognized specialty by then. And they recognized the UK diploma as an entry qualification, but not the New Zealand one. So I enrolled to do it and went over and did the revision course and some of the kind of fun experiential things that I just arranged for myself, you know, centrifuge, altitude chambers, and visit to Martin Baker and so on, and then did the exam. And then they promptly changed the rules so that I actually needn't have done that, but it was effective.
Brilliant.
I then ended up on the staff of teaching on the Otago diploma for actually 20 years. So,
and how were they different?
The Otago qualifications very much focused on civil aviation medicine. So the UK one, certainly when I did it, you know, you had to learn all of the genealogy of the RAF helmets and of the ejection seats. Mm. And a lot of detail about equipment that was really specific to military and even more specific to the UK. But, you know, for some people that would be a pain, but I found that really, really interesting. The Otago one is self-paced, you know, so people do their own learning.
Okay.
I'd love to say that it was an economical alternative, but actually, the fees are so high currently that that's not necessarily true.
And interestingly enough, in the lecture hall for RAF Henlow at the Diploma of Aviation Medicine in King's College, there's pictures of the class groups and the year groups. And I had a good look at those because I just thought, you know, who are these interesting people that did it all these years ago, decades ago in the 80s and the 70s? So are you saying that you were possibly in one of those photos that I've seen in 2019, and now I'm talking to you?
I should be in one of those photos, Daniel, as well. The other thing I was going to tell you is I was also at ASMA this year in Reno, so we should have talked face-to-face.
Oh, that's a real shame that we missed out on that opportunity there, David. I'm sure it would have been fascinating. But hey-ho, I'm sure that we'll meet sometime in a future ASMA or something like that. So it'd be great. So one of the things I'm interested in then, David, is the Otago DIPAV Med. Is that something that's open to everyone, or do you have to fulfill specific requirements in order to be able to actually access it?
Yeah, great question. It is specifically for doctors, so you need to have a medical qualification. But other than that, no, we've had students from all over the world. In my current role at IATA, I have a medical advisory group of around 10 airline medical officers from various parts of the world, and half of them are Otago graduates. Yeah, there's been folks from every continent except Antarctica. Must be well over 1,000 graduates now, for sure, because it's been running around 30 years.
Now, just off the back of that question, I'm really interested in what opportunities you see for graduates of the diploma, because classically, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was to prepare doctors to be aviation medical examiners, and usually that was in the Air Force. And now there's of course the Civil Aviation Authority backing some trainees for aviation aerospace medicine in the UK. But those of us who aren't in that training program or aren't in the Air Force, for example, myself, I'm in anesthetics and I've got this behind me. What kind of opportunities and what kind of advice would you give to people that are thinking about it, but thinking, actually, perhaps it's not for me because I'm not in the Air Force or another situation where it's obvious?
Yeah, it's a really important question because there aren't huge numbers of these roles around the world. And the ones that do exist are primarily in these three categories. So military, civil aviation doctors, and thirdly, the airlines, that's the smallest group. By no means all of the airlines, in fact, not even all of the major airlines, have their own medical officers. But there are a few other interesting groups as well, you know, International SOS / MedAir, that provide medical assistance around the globe.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Gone through these types of training courses. There are the folks who do medical retrievals, either fixed wing or helicopter pre-hospital stuff. And the aviation medicine diplomas or masters are not specifically tailored for that, but they do have certainly relevance. So there are a few different things there.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful. And it definitely gives hope to a lot of people who are kind of lost in all these different qualifications. That's great. Thank you.
So leading on from that, you talked a little bit about your sort of opportunities that have opened up to you with the diplomas that you did and obviously the various experiences that you have. What was the next steps after spending some time after you've left the Air Force now and then dabbled a little bit in the various different career paths? You went to Air New Zealand straight after that, or was there a little bit of anything else that happened before?
Good question. No, I actually worked for an air ambulance organisation in New Zealand for about a year, and that was partly medical assistance type work, so dealing with cases, you know, people who are unwell overseas and trying to advise their insurers on whether they were getting the right sort of care or whether they needed to come home, and occasionally doing the retrieval flights, either on civilian aircraft or on air ambulance aircraft for short-range ones. And we also trained up to work on the helicopter, but the helicopter wasn't manned by doctors at that stage. So I never did any of that actual real active pre-hospital stuff in helicopters. So that was about a year I did that. And then the opportunity arose to join Air New Zealand as their only medical officer. And I took that up. They'd just undergone a fairly severe restructure and reduced the medical department to almost nothing, but retained one MO position, which I took. And, you know, again, that just led to a whole lot of fascinating work experiences.
So that leads me on quite nicely. So what was your role at Air New Zealand? What does a chief medical officer, or any medical officer really, at a major airline, what's the day-to-day job look like for you?
The day-to-day job is never what you think it's going to be in the morning when you arrive. A lot of it is reactive to things that come up. But there's a mixture. So you're at least in my experience, involved with routine and non-routine assessments of pilots particularly. So you want those pilots who are unwell to be able to get back to work as soon as possible. So it's far better to manage that within the airline than to have them just go to their outside medical examiner who's a GP and just does this as a little bit of a sideline and isn't really that interested and doesn't understand the workplace. So it's, you know, it's occupational medicine at its core. The routine medicals, stuff that often isn't that interesting, but sometimes is very, very, very interesting. And it's a really good way to get to know the aircrew within your airline. Similar sorts of things for the cabin crew. And then there's all the occupational medicine for the ground staff as well. And then the interesting aspect that is additional to all that is the passenger work. So what's going to be in the medical kits on board? What's the training of the cabin crew in medical matters going to look like? How do you do that efficiently? What about if somebody gets sick in flight? How does the airline respond to that? These days, mostly that gets done by a ground-based provider such as Medlink in Phoenix for a lot of the major airlines around the world. But back when I started, that didn't exist. So there, if somebody got sick on board, there was no Medlink. There was just Dave Link. So they would call me.
Sorry.
try and make sense of it. Fascinating work, really. Suddenly the phone goes and it's a flight in the middle of the Pacific and it's somebody having an anaphylactic reaction. Should they go to Hawaii, which is an hour and a half away, or should they carry on to the United States?
Oh, so wow. So those are like pretty intense decisions that you've got to make. Obviously, we can't talk about any specific cases here, but what are the sort of things that you have to balance when giving that sort of advice to a flight in the middle of a Pacific?
So one of the most important questions, and always my first one, is nothing to do with the patient. It's where are you? So because that actually gives you the crucial parameters for the decision that's going to be coming up, which is, do they divert? Do they carry on? Or option three is, do you just wait for a while and reassess? So, yeah, question one is, where are you? And question two is really about how good are these comms? Because back then we didn't have satellite communications on all of the aircraft. In fact, almost none of them when I started. So you were doing this through HF radio, shortwave radio, like the BBC World Service, sort of that wavy, distorted,
oh, wow,
distant, staticky business, terrible mode of communication. So you lose all the light and shade in the comms, and you also might lose the comms altogether. So you've got to try and extract the maximum information on that first call and also pre-plan what they're going to do if they can't contact you again. So quite a bit of operational stuff. And then comes the medicine, you know, what's the problem? And you may or may not know what's actually going on, because you might have somebody on board who's really fantastic and have made a great assessment, or you might have nobody on board who's much use at all, you know. So in that sort of situation, who's the most useful in that scenario? Actually, a paramedic, an experienced intensive care, wow, paramedic would be the best, because they're used to uncontrolled situations. A doctor, well, it kind of depends on the specialty, right? So if there's somebody who flies on a helicopter, fantastic. But if they're somebody who's working way outside their specialty, they may not be much use at all, particularly if they're three wines in and anxious about their role and they can't see well or hear well and have a language barrier with the passenger. So all of those really interesting things. The introduction of ground-based medical advice to airlines is a great advance, really, so that we're not totally reliant on those doctors who are onboard volunteers. The other thing I was going to mention there is liability.
Absolutely. So it seems that a lot of the role of a medical officer with the airline is managing risk and medical risk, and obviously putting interventions there in place to keep the plane, you know, on track where it's going. Now, my next question is about medical escorts and commercial repatriations and evacuations. Now, part of the role of a medical officer at airline is, of course, saying yes to, you know, taking some patients commercially and no to others. What does that involve, and what are the complexities about that? Because I've had patients that, you know, have been declined that we thought actually, you know, we should be able to take this patient, and patients that we thought actually this patient, you know, it's quite unwell, and airlines have said yes. So I'm really interested to, you know, see how that was for you actually making those decisions.
Thanks, Daniel. Yeah, you're right about managing risk. And the really interesting thing is that the people who get sick in flight are almost never the ones who have submitted a MEDIF form in the first place. And that makes sense if you think about it. So you sit in the airline receiving these forms, you know, dozens of them per day, and screening them and looking for the person that might cause a problem in flight. But what I think it's easy to forget is that what you're looking at is a pre-screened sample. So for you to receive that form means a few things. It means that somebody, whether the passenger or the travel agent or their doctor, somebody has thought, maybe this could be a problem. The second thing is that somebody has talked to a doctor, or at least somebody alleges to be a doctor, and they have written on the form that they think this person's going to be okay, and they've signed it. And they've sent that to the airline. So the risk isn't in those people, those forms that you receive. It's in the ones you didn't receive. And so, you know, somewhat facetiously, I have said that you could perhaps make an argument to just shred all of those meta forms, because and worry about the rest. And
wow,
there's a way that we can approach this probably better in future, which is to try and do some better upfront screening through the website when people are booking through a website. But it's tricky. It's tricky. You are absolutely reliant on what people tell you.
David, I think you've highlighted a nice gap with the market there. You know, we can talk about the profit split later on, because I've had many a headache filling in MedIFs, because there's so much information there. You want to get it right, and you want to make sure it's done properly. You want to get this patient home or get them to the care, and it's just taking so long. So I think that process, in my opinion, is that globally it could just be done so much better, and a lot of people would benefit for that.
I outsourced a lot of the decision making, or I put it at arm's length at least. So we had a whole group of non-medical people that I just gave them about 10 questions to answer with the MedIFs that they received. And if all of those were a yes, they could approve them without even reference to the medical team. Because, you know, I really honestly think that that you can stratify those into just a few that are potentially a risk, and the rest are okay.
It might be useful, actually, for any listeners who aren't familiar with these forms, to explore what is a MedIF form exactly?
Yeah, the MedIF is an official international code for medical information form. So most major airlines have these. The idea was that there'd be a standardized form for the entire world. That never worked. So all the airlines kind of create their own. And the doctor whom the patient sees gets a hold of this form, prints it out, writes the details on there, reads the form, hopefully, but often not, and they sign it and then scan it to the airline whose team peruse that and try and work out whether this is going to be okay or not.
So it's a form that if somebody's, for example, suspicious that they're going to be unsafe to travel on an airline, then they'll get a suitably qualified professional to fill it out. They send it to the airline to make sure that person's fit to fly. Is that reasonably?
Absolutely. So you're on holiday in Corfu in Greece. You've had a heart attack. You've been admitted to a hospital. You've been discharged yesterday. When can you fly home? So when I started with Air New Zealand, automated external defibrillators, AEDs, were a new thing, really. And there had been only a couple of airlines that had played with putting these on board. And we decided that it was time to do this. In fact, that we'd had a trial of it, but it hadn't been deemed useful. But we looked into it and got approval to buy these and put them on board. And with amazing luck, within 3 weeks of putting them on, we had a successful in-flight defibrillation.
Wow. And,
it was one of those rare moments when Murphy's Law did not prevail and everything went right. So it was a long-haul flight across the Atlantic, and there were two anaesthetists, who are a married couple, boarding the airplane, and they overheard the crew talking about the new defibrillator.
Wow. Okay. This story just got a bit more interesting.
And they said, "Oh, we'd love to see that. Could you show us after takeoff?" And they said, "Yeah, sure." So they literally got briefed on and shown the AED. And then, you know, just an hour or two later, a gentleman in the upstairs business class where there was lots of room stood up and collapsed on the floor right in the middle of the most spacious part of the aircraft and right next to these two anaesthetists. Opposite whom were an intensive care nurse and a GP and a baronet from the Order of St.
Wow.
And so.
You definitely didn't set this up, right? You definitely didn't set this up.
Amazing. The anaesthetists, of course, intubated as they always would, and because we had intubation gear in our kit. And they deployed the AED, and it took a number of shocks, but got this guy back into sinus rhythm, and he woke up, pulled his own ET tube out, and they diverted into the nearest port, and he was alive and well thereafter. Amazing.
That is gorgeous. That is absolutely beautiful. That's exactly what you want. It couldn't have gone any better.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize that they had intubation kits on board aircraft nowadays. Is there anything else that they've got? What do they have on an onboard medical kit on your average major airline?
It used to vary hugely, but now it's prescribed in legislation both in the US and the EU. So they tend to be fairly consistent. There's a range of useful resuscitation type drugs. A very small amount of IV fluid, you know, just a liter or two generally. There's airway gear. Now, intubation equipment isn't universal, and we were actually unusual in having that back then. These days, a laryngeal mask airway might be a more common thing. But the bag mask, I think, is what's specified, and oropharyngeal. EpiPens, of course, typically, or if not, then at least adrenaline that can be injected. Remember that most of this stuff never gets used, and these kits are opened to have everything thrown out and then replaced by new equipment every 6 months. But every now and then, they absolutely get kind of trashed and many, many things used.
Wow, that's fascinating. I didn't realize that there was standardized legislation for this, but obviously it makes complete sense. I am a bit conscious of time, David, and I'd love to spend time exploring this further, but I have to ask. So your current role now at the at IATA, how did that happen after Air New Zealand? How did you end up transitioning there, and what's that been like, especially over the time period we've had?
Yes, I'd left Air New Zealand and done my own thing for a couple of years, and then worked for Virgin Australia as their group medical officer for, again, a couple of years. But the opportunity came up because the medical advisor to IATA was retiring, and they had made a change which was to allow this role to be done remotely. So rather than needing to move to Montreal for what actually was a part-time job, I could do that from my home in New Zealand. So I leapt at that and started that in 2018. And that was a relatively quiet job for about 18 months, and then COVID arrived.
Wow. It would be quite useful to just, for those who don't know what IATA is, if you could just quickly explain what it is, and where you fit into that whole structure.
IATA is the International Air Transport Association. So it's the international voice of the airlines. It's an unusual organization. It's essentially a non-profit because it's there to work for the airlines of the world, but it is a kind of a commercial organization with a very, very commercial focus. It has this one single medical advisor role, and that's about advising the airlines of the world on anything that relates to important medical matters within airlines. And one of the key things about that is outbreaks, and preparing for and responding to outbreaks. So I had a reasonable sized mailing list, email list that I would update every few weeks on various outbreaks that were popping up in various parts of the world. And I can well remember on what was for me New Year's Day 2020, but for most of my recipients it was New Year's Eve, just mentioning this cluster of atypical pneumonia cases in Wuhan, China, numbering 27, wow. I think it was at the time, and noting that there were some concerns that this might be SARS, but it sounded like something different. And so that went out on New Year's Day. And by the 23rd of January, I was asked to be one of the participants or advisors to the WHO's Emergency Committee, which met that week and determined that it wasn't yet a public health emergency of international concern. A week later, it met again, and the numbers were very different by then. They, of course, declared it to be a PHEIC. And so the next couple of years, really, I was just full-time COVID, all of it done remotely. Wow. In fact, not all. In March of 2020, we hurriedly organised a get-together in Singapore of a bunch of airline folks, including their medical advisors, and a couple of infectious disease and virology experts, just to talk about what it was we were facing, what the health threat was, what the economic threat was, how we could best respond to that, how we could best ensure that people could continue to fly safely. Within a week, that became a nonsense because nobody was flying anywhere.
I have to ask then, how does IATA monitor these outbreaks? I mean, in my head, I'm imagining a sort of mission control center thing, and you're just seeing these things pop up. But I'm sure it's a lot different from what we're imagining.
It used to be just monitoring a few kind of sites like like ProMed and NathNAC and CDC and the WHO itself on a regular basis. But as COVID progressed, it became a real challenge to deal with information, which was just coming in floods. There's also a Canadian organization called Blue Dot, which has got some fairly sophisticated software for tracking outbreaks. And more recently, you may be aware of Airfinity, which is a service that has a large number of analysts looking at inputs from both public health information, as we've discussed, but also media information all over the world.
Oh, wow.
Filtering that and presenting a distilled package of information. And then, so my role was to take that sort of collected information and distill it down even further to what's relevant to the airline world and put that out on my channel, which goes to a few hundred people in airline medical roles. And that update process I was doing daily in the early parts of COVID, and nowadays it's about every week.
Thank you, David, for that. I'm really interested in your work behind aircraft design and COVID transmission in the aircraft. Now this is a big area for concern for a lot of people, even now, and obviously was beforehand. And I remember seeing some really interesting aircraft designs, cabin designs and seats, and obviously having the middle seat free as well. I know you did some really interesting work behind that and with that.
Yeah, the pandemic for us in the airline world has kind of presented a series of phases. And each phase had a key question. And undoubtedly, the first phase was, what's the risk of this thing being transmitted on board the aircraft? that was the big thing. You know, how do we take a flight without catching it? And so that was the preoccupation, and we were looking at case investigations, you know, where it was suspected that there'd been transmission on board, and also quite a lot about what's the nature of the airflow on board and how can we estimate and manage the risk of that transmission. And it's probably worth saying at this point that what a lot of people don't realize is that the airflow on a modern airliner is way better than most indoor environments that you experience. The main exception probably being the being an operating theater or a clean room and where they manufacture silicon chips, for example. But most indoor environments have a pretty low air exchange rate and air flow rate. On board an airliner, it's about 10 times that. And it's also quite carefully directed. So the flow is such that there's very little fore to aft flow along the airline cabin. It's mostly from above to below. So the inlets are in the ceiling, the outlets are down near the floor. It's also designed to circulate in a particular way so that it's kind of not going too much across the aisles. So that's the reason why typically in investigations of onboard spread, they've regarded the two rows before and after the index case as being the risk area. That's sort of by and large been the case through the pandemic. But there is some spread. So there's no question, you know, you can transmit this in flight, but it's all about what is the risk and how can it be better managed. And, of course, one of the things that we eventually got to was the use of masks on board would reduce that risk. The second phase of the pandemic really was where we where the question shifted to it was all about borders, and you know, all these amazing border restrictions were brought in against the advice of the WHO actually, and so then it was, well, how can we provide alternatives to these quarantines or border closures? So then the question is about not in-flight transmission, but importation or translocation of infection from one place to another. And so our focus was all on testing and how could we use pre-flight testing or even post-flight in order to reduce that risk of translocation so that the border restrictions didn't have to be so draconian as to kill off aviation. And then the third phase was where the vaccines arrived and how would we modify the risk with vaccine. But then it changed again with Delta. And then, of course, it changed dramatically with Omicron because suddenly this changed. In my view, it was a new pandemic when Omicron came along. We went from something that was essentially controllable to something that wasn't.
And this is particularly timely because I've just come back from Kilimanjaro, and on the mountain and during the expedition, I was fine, you know, a little bit of coughing here and there. And all the participants that I was climbing with were fine. But as soon as I arrived back in the UK, I started feeling unwell. 2 days later, I was positive with COVID. And having listened to what you said and thinking what happened, I'm pretty sure that, not that I got it in the airplane, but I'm pretty sure I got it in the airport.
Daniel, thanks for raising that. Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is really commonly forgotten. You know, I see these papers where they've analyzed a cohort of passengers, and this was the person that had COVID, and here were all the other people that got it afterwards. And here's where they were seated in the aeroplane. But actually, the journey involves a whole lot of phases: the transport to the airport, the transit through the airport, through all those kind of choke points, where there's screening going on for security or check-in or baggage or And then there's the boarding and disembarkation. And actually, if you look at the airflow and the movement of people, the cruise phase of the flight is probably the lowest risk of them. There's the airflow that I've described to you. People talk about HEPA filters as if it's such a, you know, they're fantastic. Well, they are fantastic, but all they do is ensure that the portion of the airflow which is recirculated is not reintroducing microorganisms. So the key thing really is the rate of airflow, the direction, the fact that people are sitting still. They tend not to be shouting or singing on the airliner, and they're all facing the same way, and there's a big physical barrier between the person behind and the person in front, which is the seat itself. So there's a number of things that are less risky about that than some of those other phases of the journey. But boarding and disembarkation is probably a key point. And there's a report just out from the US government that is really encouraging research into a number of those higher risk areas of the journey, including that. Sorry, long answer to a short question.
Not at all. So there's a lot of other points basically that have been identified as being almost higher risk than actually the aircraft environment. And that's something to sort of bear in mind when, well, we're transiting through airports and we're continuing our travel, I think is the message there. Is that right?
Yeah. Certainly, I don't think it makes sense to go through the taxi ride, the airport, the boarding process with a mask off and then put it on when you're sitting in your seat. If I had to make a bet, it would be the other way around, actually.
Understood. What sort of expectations did you have from COVID, perhaps at the start in that February, sort of January sort of time? And how much has the way that the pandemic has changed what you expected it to be? And if it's, you know, and if it's different, then why was it different, do you think?
I think at the start, a lot of us thought, okay, this will be another SARS. You know, we'll be able to sort of stop this in its tracks. But a few things kind of changed that view. And I can recall that one of the Chinese health ministers saying, back in January, this thing can transmit asymptomatically. And I thought, well, if that's the case, then there's no way we can defeat this. And I never found out on what he based that statement, but wow, that score turned out to be right.
Back in January 2020, that's crazy.
Yes indeed. But nobody predicted the degree of shutdown that would occur between countries, and so the economic forecasts, you know, even the most dire ones were not as bad as actually took place. The other thing is I recall on his way to the emergency committee meeting, a Hong Kong professor making a comment to media that this thing could end up infecting 80% of the world's population. And I scoffed and I thought, what a ridiculous statement. Well, it certainly wasn't ridiculous, was it?
I'm interested to know, what do you think were the main lessons then that were learned from the way that the International Airline Transport Association dealt with the virus? And is there anything that you can pick out that you think we should have done differently or anything like that?
Oh, gosh, so many.
yeah, that's a biggie, isn't it?
WHO said, well, right at the start, border closures, traffic and trade restrictions don't tend to work, and they tend to have really severe side effects. Well, they were absolutely right on that. We suffered all of that pain, and for limited gain, but you know, not none. I live in New Zealand, and we kept the virus out really largely for a very long time, and had a vastly reduced death rate as a result. So, you know, it's not simple. So difficult. The other thing was, international coordination failed in so many ways, but where it succeeded, it probably succeeded when there were strong pre-existing networks already in place. There were groups who were already talking to each other. You can't formulate those networks in the middle of the crisis. They've got to be there beforehand. But yeah, I think we could have an entire podcast on lessons learned.
So actually, we've managed to touch on so many different topics. Thank you, David. We talked about COVID. We talked about the RAF, the educational opportunities, diplomas, qualifications. Of course, you know, being in the Middle East and having that experience, post-traumatic stress, training, anesthetics, GP, emergency medicine. There's such a lot that we've packed into such a small time. And actually, I think it's really important. And we hope we get the opportunity to unpack these amazing, really interesting topics in further episodes. And to be honest, actually, that's what this season is going to be about. Going to be about, you know, being able to, you know, look at more specific examples of situations and actually hammering home that concise educational content, because that's what people want. And we're really looking forward to doing that. And of course, if you have, this is for the people at home, if you have, you know, ideas or anything you want to say, please reach out to us on our social media platforms.
So David, I can only echo what Daniel has had to say. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm aware that we are running out of time a little bit, and one of the big things that we want to do with this podcast is, as you know, open it up to as many people as we can. For those people who perhaps listen to your story and were particularly inspired and want to be where you are right now, what's the sort of advice that you would give them, or particular experiences and opportunities that you would draw off?
Well, I think this is perhaps an example of where, you know, medicine's really broad. So if you can't find something that lights your fire within medicine, you're probably not trying hard enough. There'll be something somewhere that that captures you. And if you find that, I think you just got to pursue it with vigor. So in the example that we've been talking about in aviation, pursuing that with vigor ideally means getting to fly if you can, if that is of interest to you, because that'll just open doors. Then pursue some sort of qualification that gives you an academic platform to stand upon. And one thing leads to another, really. And then the third thing is to try and look for some sort of role within the industry. And that might involve having to travel to find it. A number of our graduates in aviation medicine have ended up spending some time in those airlines which have quite big medical teams, and a number of those are in the Middle East, Emirates, Etihad, Qatar. So opportunities like that should just be grabbed if possible, and it can lead interesting places.
That's amazing, David. So basically, find your fire, take that first step, and grab and look for those opportunities as and when you find them. I think that's a really, really nice way to end off. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I have two very quick fire questions that I want to shoot away at David. Number one, if you can only take one piece of medical equipment with you with a sick patient traveling on a commercial airline, what would it be?
Ooh, I like that.
The two pieces of equipment you're going to most need are oxygen and some sort of communication device to talk to the ground.
Love that. Love that. The thing that I had in my mind that I thought you were going to say was oxygen SATS monitor, but actually, what are you going to do with it if it's low? Give oxygen.
I think we'll start wrapping up. So, David, thank you so much once again for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. And if you do have some time to speak to us a little bit further about the lessons from COVID, well, I'm sure that's something that we would all want to listen to.
I'd be delighted. And look, thanks for the opportunity. Keep up the great work, guys.
All right. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading and listening to our podcast. We hope that you gained a lot from it.
And if you'd like to hear some more stuff like this, much more, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you found this on. And if you like what you heard, drop us a rating too.
You can also give us a follow on our social media accounts. We are at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And once again, that's at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter.
Also, we like to hear your feedback, of course, improve. So let us know your thoughts by emailing us at aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com. That's aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com.
Until next time, though, thanks so much again for listening. Stay safe, keep aiming high, and we will see you very, very soon.